From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The execution this past Friday of a prominent Shia cleric and others in Saudi Arabia had UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon making an appeal for calm after Riyadh announced on Saturday that Sheikh Namir Bakir al-Namir was among 47 who had been executed by the Saudi government. The mass beheadings, reportedly the highest single-day tally since 1980, sparked condemnation and protests around the world, which included the ransacking of the Saudi embassy in Iran's capital, Tehran. Last year, Saudi Arabia executed 158 people, its largest tally in two decades. In a phone call with the UN Secretary General, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said the killing of Sheikh Namir was a continuation of a policy that has wreaked havoc in the region and beyond, warning that Riyadh provokes extremism. Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah accused the Saudi ruling family of seeking to ignite civil war between Sunni and Shiite Muslims across the planet. UN Human Rights Chief Zayed Ra'ad Al Hussein expressed concerns over the application of the death penalty in Saudi Arabia and the rising number of executions carried out by Riyadh. Deanne Penn filed this report.
The UN Human Rights High Commissioner, Zayed Ra'ad Al Hussein, encouraged the Saudi government to impose a moratorium on executions and to work with the UN and other partners on what he called other strategies to combat terrorism. Zayed also expressed concern over what he saw as the recent sharp increase in executions in Saudi Arabia. Last year, 157 people were put to death, compared with 90 in 2014 and lower numbers in previous years, he stated. The High Commissioner said this was a very disturbing development indeed, particularly when considering that some of those executed were accused of nonviolent crimes. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
This past September, Faisal bin Hassan Trad, Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, was elected to chair a panel of five diplomats at the UN Human Rights Council. That panel has the power to select experts to investigate human rights violations in countries where the UN has a mandate. At the time of the announcement, on September 22nd of last year, the beheaded Sheikh's 21-year-old nephew, Muhammad al-Namir, was also awaiting execution. He was charged with texting messages of support to protesters in Saudi Arabia. State Department spokesperson Mark Toner was questioned about that death sentence and about human rights generally in the Saudi kingdom.
Saudi Arabia.
Yesterday, Saudi Arabia was named to head the Human Rights Council, and today I think they announced that they're about to behead a 21-year-old Shia activist named Muhammad al-Namir. Are you aware of that?
I'm not aware of the trial that you or the verdict.
Well, apparently he was arrested when he was 17 years old and kept in juvenile detention, then moved on, and now he's been scheduled to be executed.
I mean, we've talked about our concerns about some of the capital punishment cases in Saudi Arabia in our human rights report, but I don't have any more to add to it.
So, well, how about the reaction to them heading the council?
Again, I don't have any comment. I don't really have a reaction to it. I mean, frankly, we would welcome it. We're close allies.
Do you think that they're an appropriate choice given, I mean, how many pages does Saudi Arabia get in the human rights report annually?
I can't give that off the top of my head, Matt.
I can't either. But let's just say that there's a lot to write about Saudi Arabia and human rights in that report. I'm just wondering if you think that it's appropriate for them to have a leadership position.
We have a strong dialogue, obviously a partnership with Saudi Arabia that spans obviously many issues. We talk about human rights concerns with them. As to this leadership role, we hope that it's an occasion for them to look at human rights around the world, but also within their own borders.
But you said that you welcome them in this position? Is it based on improved record? I mean, can you show or point to anything where there is, you know, a sort of stark improvement in their?
I mean, we have an ongoing discussion with them about all these human rights issues, you know, like we do with every country. We make our concerns clear when we do have concerns, but that dialogue continues. But I don't have anything to point to in terms of progress.
Would you welcome a decision to commute the sentence of this young man?
Again, I'm not aware of the case, so it's hard for me to comment on it. Other than that, we believe that any kind of verdict like that should come at the end of a legal process that is just and in accordance with international legal standards.
At the time of this broadcast, the younger Al-Namir remained in a Saudi prison awaiting beheading. Tensions between Riyadh and Tehran arising from Friday's beheadings by the Saudis signify a larger geopolitical game between the two that is being played out across the region and beyond, including into Africa. That, according to political analyst Eric Dratzer, as he described on this past weekend's edition of CPR Sunday.
Nigeria seems to be the flashpoint. Nigeria seems to be, sort of the hot spot where a number of different interests, both regionally and continentally, and of course globally, seem to be converging. I think the biggest news out of Nigeria of the last month or so is probably what a lot of people have already heard about. It is the killing of Sheikh Zakzaki's family and many of his followers in the Islamic movement in Nigeria. And this has obviously made international headlines because Zakzaki and the Islamic movement in Nigeria are backed by Iran, and they are Shia in, of course, in a country that is divided between Christians and Muslims, who are almost, I think it's more than 95% Sunni in Nigeria's north. So it's a complicated ethnic and religious situation or makeup in Nigeria, and within that sort of complicated ethnic map, you have this Islamic movement led by this guy Sheikh Zakzaki, who is traditionally pretty much unanimously understood to be very, very close to the political and religious establishment in Iran. So I think that this is really the way that we need to examine this issue, is the extent to which Zakzaki is in effect a proxy of Iran. And more importantly, if we're to accept that premise, and certainly not everyone does, but if we're to accept that premise, then the attack on Zakzaki is in effect part of a broader war, proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. That's my contention here. Yeah.
Yeah, on that very point, the claims that Zakzaki is an Iranian agent in one fashion or another, of course, come from a Sunni hierarchy that has Saudi Arabia's hands all over it. So in effect, you have Saudi Arabia accusing him of being
Iranian. Exactly. Yeah.
So that's both sides there.
Exactly. There's no doubt about that. And, the Qataris and the Saudis got proxies all over West Africa, all throughout the Sahel, all over North Africa. So that's kind of what I'm getting at here, is whether or not you accept Zakzaki as, agent of the Iranians is sort of a moot point. The Saudis certainly do. And the Iranians have certainly, and Shias internationally have certainly rallied around the Zakzaki cause. So even if the Islamic movement is not an Iranian proxy, it's certainly in the propaganda sphere operating as in the sphere of Iran. And that's really, again, I'm not wanting to make an argument one way or the other about that per se. Certainly we could debate that endlessly, probably. Sure. What I'm most interested in is the global implications of what we're seeing here, because it seems to me that the Saudis have been put, and the Qataris as well, have been pushing very strongly all throughout the Sahel and West Africa to increase their influence, to grow their influence. And I think that a reasonable argument could be made, and I certainly would not discount it, that the move against Zakzaki was driven by the Saudis and or the Qataris for the purpose purposes of dealing a blow to Iranian power projection in light of Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey increasingly losing in Syria. See, this is where I think these issues are connected, where the Saudis and the other Gulf, the reactionary feudal monarchies of the Gulf, where their mission in Syria is collapsing and they're losing, they look to approach the global proxy war against Iran from another angle, from another direction. Right. And I think that's what Zakzaki is. And I know we're going to get to it in a minute, but I think that that's also part of the motivation for the execution of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr in Saudi Arabia. Again, this is the way that the Wahhabi Saudis are sending a message to the Iranians that they should not believe that just because they're winning in Syria, that they are actually winning the global proxy war. And remember, West Africa factors centrally into the foreign policy of both the United States and its NATO allies, the former colonial powers, on the one hand, and China, and to a lesser degree, but increasingly so, Russia as well. So there is also the largest, call it macro level of geopolitics here, wherein the United States and NATO on the one hand, Russia, China on the other hand, Nigeria, of course, becoming increasingly a proxy battlefield.
Yeah, and you know, there's a couple of things nested in there that are important. I think maybe we could blow out a little bit. First is, the demonstrative value of taking out Zakzaki isn't only perhaps for the benefit of the elite in Iran and those watching, but also inside Saudi Arabia. Because yes. the king has been besieged by people inside the royal family, and he has to show some victory somewhere, because they've been calling for him to step down, or worse, sometimes heads roll there as a part of that project. The other is, if you look at the ongoing Saudi and Qatari project, take it back to the NATO bombing coverage in Libya that essentially was the air force for Qatari and Saudi-backed and Qatari-commanded takeover of Libya. And that happened simultaneously with the beginning of the war in Syria. And also you had the revolution-turned Muslim Brotherhood election-turned military coup in Egypt. You had, sort of thrust-parry-thrust in Egypt. So, as they went into the entire North African region, if you actually, hold a map in your head while you do it, and you look at Syria, Egypt, Libya, and then points west and south from Libya, it's part of the same war.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I think you're absolutely right. And of course, you and I have talked about it. I've written about, the flow of weapons and the flow of fighters out of Libya and how that impacted everything that happened in Mali, how that's impacted everything that's happened in Chad, how that was a direct antecedent to the source of the growth of Boko Haram, which is, of course, central to a lot of what's happening in Nigeria right now. So absolutely, there are a number of ramifications there, from the Eric, war on Libya, and you're Eric, again
Eric,
absolutely
let yeah. me add one other thing in there, because actually, as an opening salvo to the war on Libya, which also, by the way, opened the continent up to AFRICOM, which is now firmly entrenched, was the insurgent war against the government in Cote d'Ivoire, which ended up with the French takeover of Cote d'Ivoire and the installation of Ouattara, who comes out of the IMF.
Right, and that is what really allowed the French if I could be allowed to use the pun, the gall, get it? The gall to have the intervention in Mali. Of course, the French in Mali were essentially reasserting their colonial rule using the terrorism as the pretext, terrorism which was directly precipitated by the French-participated NATO bombardment of Libya. So absolutely. I mean, all signs go back to Libya as really the starting point for a lot of this. But to bring it back to the point you were making, which is an absolutely critical one, Don, and I'm really glad you made it, that really the Qatari and Saudi footprint can also be, and especially the Qatari footprint, can also be directly attributed to Libya, because of course the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, the various al-Qaeda elements that were used to overthrow and to murder Gaddafi and to destroy the country, they were all on the payroll of the Qataris and the Saudis, with the Qatari Air Force literally being, you know, I mean, the Qataris being in command, as Al Jazeera reported it in 2011. So, you know, there's a number of factors here to point us in the direction when it comes to Zakzaki and Nigeria, that again, what we're seeing is obviously a move by the Saudis and or the Qataris to push back against Iran in the region and to show that they are the dominant power there when it comes to the countries from the Arab and Muslim world. Now, obviously, nothing happens in Africa without the United States. Nothing happens without the consideration of the larger geopolitical implications for the United States and NATO on the one hand, and China on the other hand. And of course, Nigeria is a central aspect of Chinese economic strategy for all of Africa, and equally so, Nigeria is a major oil-producing cash cow for the West. And so there are a lot of larger implications here. Now, let me throw one other thing to complicate this matter even further. There's another issue besides Boko Haram, besides the killing of Zakzaki, that people need to watch, and it's very underreported. You almost read nothing about it, and that is ethnic strife, ethnic conflict that is being fomented by the United States for the purposes of breaking up the country. Because on the one hand, I think a lot of people know that there's a division in Nigeria between the North and the South, the North being Muslim, the South being Christian. I think this is pretty well known, pretty well understood by most people who follow these issues. But what many people miss is that there are also major conflicts between the larger ethnic groups in the country, in particular, the Yoruba people. The Yoruba ethnic group has traditionally been very, let's say, if not resistant, then certainly uneasy about the federalized system that exists in Nigeria. They have long since been agitating for increased autonomy. And based on my own research over the course of the last couple of years, I could tell you that the United States is busy fomenting precisely that thinking, using former Nigerian generals who are wealthy landowners of the Yoruba ethnic group to essentially agitate for Yoruba independence. Now, I'm not old enough, of course, to remember this, but Don, I think you would, and certainly people of your generation would, the Biafra War. And the Biafra War was essentially exactly what I just described, this ethnic war in regards to the Yoruba people and potential independence. Now, if we see simultaneously the growth of Boko Haram, the growing division between Muslim and Christian, growing sectarian divides within the Muslim community, and on top of that, Yoruba agitation for independence, well, we know where this is all going. This is going towards the breakup and or balkanization of Nigeria, something that many people in the imperial establishment have long since talked about, that Nigeria was quote-unquote unsustainable, that this was a country that was, you know, quote-unquote just barely held together and so forth. That type of talk, I think, really reinforces what I believe is the U.S. strategy in Nigeria, which is ultimately, if not to break it up formally, then to break it up de facto in order to deprive China of one of its main trading partners on the African continent.
And Nigeria is also an entree into the next tier BRICS-like groups, the so-called MINT groups. You have Mexico, Indonesia, Nigeria, and I don't know how, but Turkey. Three of those, great oil reserves, Mexico and Indonesia, also have an awful lot of petroleum. And, if you can work the members of those countries from the inside, as certainly they have done with Mexico.
Yeah, exactly.
Certainly, you look at Turkey is also going through similar stresses. And Indonesia's had that kind of tension, you know, going back to the 1960s.
It's a great point, Don. And let me just say this, too. Remember that Mexico, under the right-wing Peña Nieto government, Mexico is doing exactly what the United States corporations have been dictating that they do, namely privatizing all of the energy production in the country, or yep. as much of it as they can. This privatization push in Mexico is one of the reasons why Mexico has looked upon favorably by the United States. On the, you know, on the contrary, Nigeria has really refused to accept the diktats of the United States when it comes to energy production, and have been looking increasingly at China as an economic outlet for some of the investment that they need. Remember, when we're talking about Nigeria, we're not talking about, you know, the, you know, one of these bottom tier in terms of GDP, in terms of economics, bottom tier African countries. Nigeria is a massive country with a massive population, a very, very vibrant market for goods, whether they're Western goods, whether they're Chinese-made goods, a huge country with massive potential for infrastructure investment, infrastructure development, precisely the kind of investment that China likes to make, advanced communication systems, satellite communication systems, and so forth. Nigeria is one of the most advanced economies in Africa, certainly on par with a lot of other countries around the world. And so Nigeria is no small prize here.
Yeah. I mean, you're looking at almost 200 million people population, or about 20% of the population of the continent in that small area.
That's right.
A GDP over $1 trillion.
Yeah, I mean, it's two-thirds of the population of the United States, and it's a country that is really pivotal for the entire course of Africa. I think a very solid argument could be made that Nigeria is the single most important country in Africa, with all due respect to South Africa and to Egypt, I think. But, you know, again, this question of Nigeria, Zakzaki, all of this fits into a broader narrative, a narrative of neocolonialism from the United States and its proxies, and then secondarily, or maybe primarily, I don't know, whatever, but secondarily, this larger proxy war between the Saudis, Qataris on the one hand, and the Iranians on the other. I think that is really how we need to understand this Zakzaki massacre issue. Now, there's a couple of questions that I don't think we're going to get answers to, at least not yet. Who got paid here? I think that's a very real question. Is there an element inside? Because I don't believe that the Nigerian president, President Buhari, sanctioned this. I think that that would be I think that that would be probably unlikely, considering that Buhari ran on a law and order platform, basically suggesting that he was going to bring peace to the north of Nigeria, that he was going to not only resolve the Boko Haram issue with military strength, but that he was going to essentially placate as best as possible the entire north of the country. But does that mean that Buhari ordered this? I suppose it's possible, but I tend to lean towards probably not. Now, the general involved, the lower, the, you know, sort of the lower ranking officials, the high ranking military officials, it's entirely possible that Saudi money changed hands or Qatari money changed hands. Somebody got paid to carry out a massacre against the Islamic movement. I think that is quite likely. And again, unfortunately, as we know with the entire post-colonial history, both in Africa and in Latin America, many of these military officials, high-ranking military officials, have direct links to the U.S. military, either through receiving U.S. military training or through joint exercises, joint cooperation, many different ways, you know, quote-unquote special advisors, well, and all of the rest of the things that the United States does. All of these various ways, I think, again, point to this broader geopolitical conflict.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, now it's fairly direct with AFRICOM, you know, in, which is essentially a command and control device that unifies the to a large degree the,
yeah.
the Confederate way, the militaries of the continent. Just as one other thing I wanted to throw out there, because, you know, the current president took office just in the last year and a half. I forget when he came in.
Less than that, I think it was.
And it was a change, So, you know, it was a change in direction. It was you know, the political call for a change in direction in any event. And previously, if you go back to to the beginning of the crisis in Cote d'Ivoire that led to the ouster of the president there, Gbagbo. Nigeria, which is a dominant power inside ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, which was intervening then, was intervening on the side of Ouattara and basically in alliance with France against the leftist government in Cote d'Ivoire. So the foreign policy of Nigeria at the time, although there have been ambiguities in it, seemed allied with the West, at least in terms of policy towards Cote d'Ivoire.
Well,
and perhaps, you know, there was a change, at least symbolically, with the new administration.
Yeah, and that's a great point, because this is something that we've seen on the African continent in a few different places. Specifically, in my mind, Ethiopia, where you have a country that is in many ways very much a lapdog of the United States, of the West, sort of their, you know, cop on the beat for the region, so to speak. You know, Nigeria being the dominant player in West Africa, Ethiopia being the dominant player in East Africa, the Horn of Africa. And so, yes, I think you're absolutely right to point that out. But as with Ethiopia, Nigeria as well has increasingly been looking at China, increasingly been trying to develop, I guess, the rudiments of what could be called a multi-vector foreign policy. Now, when a puppet state or a client state or a proxy state begins to explore the multi-vector foreign policy avenue, that sets off alarm bells in Washington and in London and in Brussels, because of course they see their position increasingly slipping there. And I think that that's precisely what we've seen in Nigeria. And I think that's also what we're seeing in Burundi.
Yeah. And then of course it's a member of what's now called the Commonwealth of Nations, but the British Commonwealth.
Right. Exactly. So, and a lot of these issues in Africa, as I think we should expect, a lot of them have their roots in the legacy of colonialism on the African continent. And I just mentioned Burundi, of course. Burundi, like Rwanda, its neighbor, a former Belgian colony in Africa in the Great Lakes region, one that has lived with the legacy of the Tutsi-Hutu divide, which has really sort of, I think, been the principal conflict in the Great Lakes region. And what we're seeing in Burundi now is a major push by the West, by the United States, by the empire against the embattled government in Burundi, because it has dared to assert some level of sovereignty and independence. And, you know, for people who haven't been following the situation in Burundi, basically earlier in 2015, the president of Burundi, President Nkurunziza, Nkurunziza basically wanted to have a chance at another term in office. Now, the constitution as written requires no, or it mandates no more than two terms. And this is now the end of Nkurunziza's second term. However, the Supreme Court in that country ruled that because Nkurunziza was not elected to his first term, he was the first president post peace accords with the new constitution, so he was appointed and then only elected for one term after that. He's actually technically only been elected once, and so he wanted a chance to be elected a second time, which would technically be a third term, but really only a second elected term. Now, this legal ambiguity, this has now been seized upon by the entire NGO establishment in the West. In particular, Amnesty International has been out in the lead on this, but also Avaaz.org and some of the others have been, I think Soros's International Crisis Group also, they have been pushing very hard to portray Nkurunziza as some kind of a dictator trying to seize control of Burundi, trying to destroy the Tutsi minority. You know, it's the same old story they retreaded over and over again in the Great Lakes region. Now, obviously, I think anybody who knows, you know, the politics of Africa, the politics of that region, should understand that that is, in effect, a smokescreen, a cover for a much larger geopolitically and strategically important issue, namely the influence and control of the United States and its regional proxies on the one hand versus the emerging powers of the BRICS on the other hand. This theme crops up over and over again when talking about Africa. And it's central when we're talking about Burundi. Burundi is, you know, more or less untapped for its mineral wealth. Obviously, the Chinese would like to get a piece of that, just like they'd like to get a piece of the mineral wealth of much of Africa in terms of their development strategy. Ultimately, that's what this is about.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.